All right, so for this next Big Shot Short, which is really just a compilation of all our guests on one particular topic, we're going to actually go deep into what makes Jewish entrepreneurs different.
Each guest had really, really interesting learnings around this. And they talk about how resilient we are, how we're people of action, how we're fiercely independent, how we don't take no for an answer.
Yeah, there's this, sort of this theme of resiliency, right? Where like Jews have had to start over so many times, and that's built this incredible, you know, I talk a lot about this idea of a surfboard, that some people see a tidal wave coming and they grab their surfboard and surf it. And other people see a tidal wave coming and they grab their towel and run for the beach. And I think Jewish entrepreneurs have this incredible, insatiable desire to grab their surfboard and figure out what's happening next. And whether it's, maybe it's something in the DNA, or maybe it's just because of the experience from the Holocaust being persecuted, it feels like there is this built-in, you know, energy, maybe some anxiety too, about success.
And no one was there to fix our problems.
That's right.
Right? I mean,
if we didn't do it, nobody else
would. You can't
write
an op-ed for the papers.
That's right.
You know, they won't let you train at hospitals. We'll build our own hospitals. And there's Mount Sinai in almost every city.
Yeah.
Jewish entrepreneurship, we show up every single day. The best ones do. And decade after decade after decade, they build community, they build family, and they build these enormous businesses.
Well, one of the things that actually comes through in all our interviews is that, you know, you've often said there are sort of two ways that people decide to become entrepreneurs. One is through passion, and one is through
necessity,
entrepreneurs by necessity. And when you look across our guests, you see a lot of these entrepreneurs by necessity. They had no choice. Nobody would give them a job, so they started their own company. Nobody would have let them into the golf club, they started their own golf courses.
Right.
No one let them into the hospital, they created their own hospitals. And that type of DNA, that type of philosophy, there's something so unique about Jewish entrepreneurs, and you can't really put your finger on why that's the case, but I love that our guests go in and try to explain it.
In many ways, Big Shot is about our stories.
Yeah.
Our stories that we've grown up with that has shaped us, you know, the people whose shoulders that we stand on when we grow these companies and how we maintain that motivation. And you look at a narrative that has been constant across Jewish entrepreneurs and in our culture, it's the idea that we've seen the worst.
Yeah.
We've seen the worst. So what is there to fear when you've already seen the worst?
Yeah.
And I think each one of these guests expresses that in their own way, and I think there's a lot to learn from that.
But the other thing I think that's worthwhile mentioning is that Jews make up less than 1% of the population.
Yeah.
But if you look across business, if you look across Nobel Prizes, we have this disproportionate impact. And part of it is that we have this great ambition and this great desire and this drive. And I think that's what we should actually compile. That should be this compilation.
Absolutely. Started from the bottom, now the whole team here. Started from the bottom, now we're here. Now we're going to hear from Charles Bronfman, who's best known for bringing the Montreal Expos to Canada. His family started Seagram's, which is makers of Crown Royal. And we're going to hear from him what makes Jewish entrepreneurs unique and how he believes there's something in the DNA.
I want to talk pick up on something you sort of said, which is someone said to you, we need the money, we can't find it. You said, go find it. There is something deeply rooted in Jewish people. This entrepreneurship thing, I think, is so unique. And I'm curious, I mean, we are, you know, David and I are inspired, we're not just blowing smoke, we are inspired by watching you and your father, and also your son. I mean, Stephen is a mentor to me and to David as well. We really admire three generations of Bronfmans. But there is something unique about the Jewish people and how they approach entrepreneurship and business. And I'd be curious to know, you've been around for nine decades, what do you think is going on here? How did this happen?
It has to have gone back a hell of a long time. There is something in the DNA, I don't know what it is, one day they'll find out, that sets us apart. And, you know, because it's not just in business. You take the legal profession, you take the music,
medicine,
the conductors, the principal players, you take art, you take any discipline you want, there is a disproportionate amount of Jewish stars, shall we call them, and even people in the orchestra or in the art world who are Jewish.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's totally unbelievable, and I don't know where it is.
Charles,
I mean, if I took a look at my son, and when he was 14, 15, 16, 17, this is Stephen, and I look at the man today, there is no relationship. They are not the same people. I would have lost a heavy bet that Stephen would turn out to be the way he is.
It's unbelievable. I mean, one of the things, obviously, that I think is part of it is this general or this inherent desire for survival. Dave and I talk about that.
Yeah, entrepreneurship by necessity.
Entrepreneurship by necessity. I mean, yeah. We are fortunate, you know, Shopify is a labor of love to me. It's a big company now. David's tea was labor, but we started this because we were interested, we were curious. But our parents, our grandparents, your father did not start because he was curious. He did so because he needed money. It was survival.
Right, yeah. Right,
and I think that survival aspect to entrepreneurship is embedded in the Jews that start those companies.
Also, who started other things, I forget his name, the guy who started what is now the Israel Philharmonic. Mm-hmm. He was a violin player, and when Hitler came in and they started weeding out the Jews from the symphony orchestras in Europe, he went around and chose people to come to Palestine at the time and play in his orchestra.
Wow.
And the first concert was conducted by Arthur Rubinstein. Amazing, just amazing. How do you do that?
You take
people and you're moving them to some, I mean, in the 30s, in the 30s. No air conditioning.
Right.
Diphtheria, all kinds of disease. Yet he did it.
There's a toughness to it.
Yeah.
Started from the bottom, now we're here.
Okay, now you're going to hear from Aldo Bensadoun, who's famous for starting Aldo Shoes, who's going to tell us what makes Jewish entrepreneurs unique and how it's really the anti-Semitism and the persecution and the unfairness that has played a huge role in that.
Where does this sort of, this uniqueness that Jewish entrepreneurs have, whether it's building big companies or creating great social impact, where do you think that comes from?
Could it be because of anti-Semitism? Could it be because people criticize us so much that we want to prove to the rest of the world that, on the contrary, you know, we are there, you know, to have, you know, a big light torch, you know, that's shine and that's beautiful, maybe.
There's sort of the survivalness,
yes,
you know, built inside
maybe
of us that,
yeah,
we have something to prove, but we also want to survive.
That's right.
And entrepreneurship, it feels almost like it's baked into our DNA in some ways.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I find so fascinating.
Yeah.
We also think a lot
and
about...
And also because of that, of anti-Semitism, we want to create like a bubble around us and create like something like... maybe, you know, like to dream, constantly to dream, and to keep dreaming and dreaming and dreaming and then executing,
yeah,
in our dream, maybe.
I love that. I think that's right. I think that there's,
yeah,
this, there is, I think that's part of the other part of it is because we couldn't, no one gave us anything, we had to do everything for ourselves.
Yeah, that's right.
We think a lot about, you know, Dave mentioned this term earlier, but forced entrepreneurship as opposed to passion-driven entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
That there were very few things, my family are immigrants, and so for them, like, entrepreneurship, they didn't call it that, it was just survival.
Sure.
It was put food on the table, put a roof over their heads.
Started from the bottom, now we're here.
Okay, now we're going to hear from Eddie Sunshine from Ryokan. And Eddie talks about how the Jewish DNA is just different, and he uses the example of how Jews created and why they created Hollywood.
There's a lot of great things about us. Do we punch above our weight? Without a doubt. I mean, it's a hard one, what I'm about to say. You know, you've got comedians like Russell Peters, Dave Chappelle, and the recent time, Jews control Hollywood. Well, we don't control Hollywood. Are we disproportionately represented there?
Probably.
For sure.
Yeah.
Guaranteed. In fact, I read a book once, and I'm sorry for wondering, but a great little book, just a little book. It was called A World of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. Because if you go back to like the 1920s and earlier,
sure,
every studio was started by Jews, Warner Brothers.
Right.
And Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer.
Yeah.
I mean, you go, Columbia. I mean, they're all started by Jews who were running away from New York because Edison had a patent on film.
Yeah.
And the light was good out there.
Yeah.
So they ran away. And they were all immigrants, some of them, or children of immigrants. And at one time, the Jews created Hollywood. They created an America that didn't exist. The Andy Hardy movies. But we do punch way above our weight. I mean, we own more basketball teams per capita, and yet, you know, in the United States, which is a much larger, well, I don't know if you ever get asked. Periodically, I get asked, how many Jews are there in Canada? And when I give them the answer, give or take 350,000. Yep. Come on.
It's less than 1%
of the global population.
They said, that's not possible.
25% of Nobel Prize winners. Yeah. 25%.
I said, look, there's only 15 million in the whole world.
Right.
And they said, what? I go, that's it. Yep. I said, guess what? We're finally back to where we were in 1938.
It's true.
The world population has doubled in the meantime. So I said, there ain't a lot of us.
Yep.
And of course, nobody, so they look at us, and that's why I think a lot of anti-Semitism is envy. Mm-hmm. A lot of anti-Semitism is, what are they doing that causes them to be disproportionately successful?
What are we doing?
There was, I think, a real focus on education. I think a real focus on self-reliance. My generation, your generation, greatest thing is to go have your own business. Be your own boss. Because of that sort of theory, you know, a feeling of self-reliance, I'm not saying we don't do it, we do, but the sort of guy who comes in at a low level in a big corporation and slowly works his way up, that's not us. There are occasions where that happens, but that's not a typical Jewish path. Typical Jewish path, go to work for a big corporation, figure out what the hell they do right.
And then go do it yourself.
Yeah. So we're entrepreneurial by nature. And I think that comes from, and the self-reliance comes from, not being able to trust that you're going to get a fair shake from the rest of the world.
They wouldn't hire us at one point.
Yeah, when I came out of law school, I graduated in 1970, a long time ago. Mm-hmm. So in 1969, I was going to look for articling positions. Well, it was well known. There was the big 7 or 8 law firms that wouldn't hire Jews.
Yep.
The banks wouldn't hire Jews.
Yeah. Goodman's wasn't around at that point, I suppose.
Goodman's was around. As Goodman and Goodman, but they hired Jews.
Yeah, they were the only one.
So we went to Goodman's, Fogler's. Mm-hmm. Goodman and Carr, Minden Gross. We created our own law firms. We created our own accounting firms.
Our own golf clubs.
Our own hospital.
Right. Well, I in my speech at TMU, and I was trying to explain that, I said, look, you ever wonder why in every city, except for Montreal, where they called it Jewish General, there's a Mount Sinai Hospital.
Yeah.
There's one in New York. There's one in Toronto. There's one in, it used to be, I mean, Cedar Sinai in Los Angeles. There's a big one in Miami. Does ever wonder about that? Well, let me explain why. Because for a long time, Jews couldn't get into medical school. Well, finally, they forced their way into being able to get into medical school. Well, great. Then they got out, and they couldn't get privileges or get accredited at the hospitals. So what do? Call a Daily Star and ask for an expose? We started our own hospital. And I said, that happened in every city throughout North America. We'd all lived through a world or seen a world where you lost everything. So what's to be afraid of? What's going to happen? Got to start over again. I've done that already.
Yeah.
So that's why, some of the survivors, our whole apartment building sector here was primarily built by survivors that started apartment buildings.
To be clear, Holocaust survivors.
Holocaust survivors, thank you. And they had no fear. What was going to happen? And they could live cheaply. They used to live off the quarters from the washing machines. And
what do you mean by that?
Wow.
Well, when you built it, if you look at the apartment buildings that are still around today and people live in them, that were being built in the 50s, and most of them date back to the 50s and 60s. Pre-war, nobody built more than a fourplex.
Yeah.
That's 4 stories high. 50s, 60s, elevator technology got better, things got better. People started building apartment buildings. CMHC encouraged it because we needed, just like now, rental housing. You had all these soldiers coming back, people having families, couldn't build houses fast enough, too expensive. So you didn't put a washer dryer in every apartment. If you look at New York's like this, down in the basement, there was a room, the laundry room. And you'd put in washing machines and dryers, and they worked on coins. I know I have friends of my dad's, they used to play cards together, they show up with a bag of coins. They literally lived off the money that was coming in the Washington.
Cuff coin laundry.
Yeah, they didn't live very well because all the money coming in would go to pay down the mortgage as quickly as, because they used to finance this to 102%.
Wow.
And CMHC, you could do it then. But they knew you had to pay down debt, get rid of the debt. And some of the wealthiest people I know in Toronto are their kids.
Right.
Who are my age now.
Yeah.
Okay, wow. Their kids. Because
they inherited these buildings.
They got the punishment of being handed.
They got the punishment of getting 8,000 apartment units with no debt. Right.
With no debt, no mortgage. They've already paid off 30 years ago.
You got it. No debt. And I won't mention his name. And he's a fairly active businessman. Yeah. And I said, dear, you're in this deal, you're in that deal. I said, what are you doing all these deals for? He says, well, I got this cash flow. I said, my dad left me 8,000 units.
Wow.
He says, you know what the cash flow
8,000 doors, 8,000 apartments we're talking about.
All in the GTA and in the city.
Yeah. Right.
And I said, I got a pretty good idea what the cash flow is. And I said, no, about 50% has to go to cost because you're paying taxes, realty taxes, insurance, all that stuff, hydro. And he says, so I got to invest it. I got to do this. I said, well, if you ever want to do a big deal, I guess you could put a mortgage on one of the buildings. Looks at me like I'm a lunatic. He said, Eddie, the one thing my dad told me before he died, don't ever put mortgages on the money tree. That's what he calls it, the money tree. Because it just
$8 million a month at $1,000.
Keeps growing money.
And he already took, the rap for this kid to be able, he lived off coin laundry.
He lived off.
Paying on his mortgage. Yeah.
Literally, I remember they used to play cards at my house and half the guys would walk in with a big, the Crown Royal bags.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The purple bags.
Purple bags filled with quarters that they, and if they ran out, they say, I'll go visit my other building. I'll be back in a half an hour. One of the things that worries me a little, okay, because I really believe one of the reasons Jews were such great entrepreneurs and wanted is because they weren't afraid of risk. You can't be, you can't be afraid of risk. Otherwise, you don't do anything. I've noticed when you're second, third generation and you're an heir, H-E-I-R, well, you are afraid of risk.
You got something to lose, obviously.
Like my friend who wouldn't put a mortgage on a money tree.
Right.
You got something to lose. We had nothing to lose.
I had nothing to lose. David had nothing to lose.
Right. So what, now some of these young people from wealthy families work very hard.
Yep.
Most don't. I joined Oakdale, which I thought I had really arrived, in 1993 or four. Okay. I didn't even play golf, but I thought it was really cool that I could join Oakdale. And until I joined Oakdale, I never knew, that there were Jews who didn't work. I meet a guy. Well, what do you? And again, I don't want to mention his name. What do you do? Well, play golf. And I go to Florida in the winter. I said, you're 42 years old. What do you mean? Well, my dad left me, this much money or buildings, this, that, and
The shirt sleeves, in three generations.
No, they don't. They're terrified of blowing
the
money.
Right, of that.
So they're afraid to take any risks.
Right.
And because he told me, he said, well, I went into a business once and I lost $2 million. That's it. Yeah. Because I got to have enough.
Yeah.
I got $10 million, so I can't afford to lose any, so I'm going to do nothing.
Right.
And try to live off the income.
I mean, part of the sort of, the creation of diamonds comes from the pressure, and when you don't have the pressure, you don't necessarily... It's tougher to make diamonds. Here's the good news. Part of this project is to inspire more people to take those risks, to become titans, to rethink entire industries. I mean, what you did in terms of the model of a real estate investment trust, what Izzy did with creating a brand new model, a business model for how hotels will be owned property and by one party, but managed by another party, and create this.
Took him a while to figure that part out.
Well, it did.
But he got there.
Multi-decade overnight success. Yeah. But not just that. I mean, I think what comes across in these interviews is just how much purpose you've found in these pursuits.
Oh, yeah.
It's life's work stuff. I mean, part of, the idea, your father never had the opportunity to do his life's work because your father, like my father,
yeah,
like
life
your father.
Interrupt us.
That's right. Yeah. Their life's work. What do you mean? Putting food on the table,
roof over their head. That is what we do. We were in survival mode.
Right.
And because they set a foundation for us, a minimum bar, we were then able to go and build these great companies, right? The key for us is to make sure we maintain that momentum, that we can actually build things that have never been built before with as much ambition and also as much humility as possible. But that makes the Jewish entrepreneurial DNA so unique. Started from the bottom, now the whole team here. I didn't keep it real from the jump. Living at my mama's house, we'd argue every month. I was trying to get it on my own.